copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
This morning, we're going to talk about something known as complex trauma. I'm assuming everybody in the room has heard of post-traumatic stress disorder. Yes? It seems to be in the news and in professional literature a great deal in the last few years, in part because there have been a lot of wars. And historically, when somebody has gone through trauma and has symptoms of being traumatized, they have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. But there's been a shift in the psychological world in the last few years, because we have come to understand that there are people who suffer from a different sort of trauma that is much more complex and is not under post-traumatic stress disorder. The definition of that disorder does not cover what those experiences are. Complex psychological trauma involves multiple repetitive chronic stressors. So it's not an event. I mean, you can have PTSD from a car accident, from an incident in a war, from gun violence on a street, from all kinds of things. But complex trauma comes when somebody is repeatedly, chronically exposed to traumatic events over years. It usually involves harm from those people in their lives who should have been caregivers. So the ones who were to care for are the ones actually doing the traumatizing. It often occurs at developmentally vulnerable times, and we'll talk more about that. And so it has a tremendous potential to severely compromise human development. So what that means is that you can have a client or patient come in to see you, or you can have somebody in your church or whatever ministry you have who appears to be one way, but is actually profoundly compromised internally because of this kind of chronic over the lifespan traumatizing. So one of the things we found out is that in complex and traumatic stressors, they are generally interpersonal. You know, you can get traumatized by a tsunami, but when you have been traumatized by your own father, it's a whole different thing. They are premeditated. They are always caused by other human beings. They involve profound relational betrayal, because it's usually some kind of caregiver, and profound deception. So it's usually repeated and chronic, and so what we have is an individual, particularly, let's think about a child, being marinated in trauma from birth. So this is a child who is developing, who is supposed to be growing and learning and blossoming, who is instead buried in this stuff called trauma at every stage. It can be physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and chronic neglect in the child's life. Complex trauma also has another category, and that is that it describes people who have layers of trauma. So on the one hand, you may have this child who's growing up in this very traumatic environment across the lifespan. That's complex trauma. The other possibility would be, suppose you're working with a veteran of a war, and he's got trauma, and you think he has PTSD, but then as you get to know him more, you realize that doesn't cover it. That's often somebody who, for example, grew up under a violent father in an alcoholic home, lived in an inner city where there was a lot of gun violence on the street, enlisted, went to war, and saw combat, and was traumatized there as well. So you have the cumulative effect of all these different traumas that occurred in different places, but it's also complex trauma. So those are the two possible subsets of that. So let's think about some of the factors involved in a situation that produces complex trauma. First of all, thinking again of a child, it results in insecure and disorganized attachments. How do you bond with parents who damage you chronically. They are exploited wherever they are vulnerable, and children are, of course, always vulnerable. They are used. Victims of this kind of trauma live in constant distress. And that has profound physiological impact on the brain, on the adrenal gland, all kinds of things that can often be things that last lifelong. They are not only under constant distress, but there's no exit door. You know, if you're 5 years old, you can't get away. So they have gross insecurity, instability, and ongoing pain and suffering. And in such an environment, the individual never gets to regain emotional equilibrium. You think about perhaps a car accident, maybe, that some of you have been in or witnessed, and how everything's thrown out of kilter. And it takes a while, particularly if you were driving, for you to even think about getting behind the wheel again and all of those things. But eventually you get some sort of emotional equilibrium and little by little can claim that area of your life back. But when you live with chronic trauma, there's no place to do that. There's no equilibrium to gain. So for many, trauma is not a terrifying event, which is how PTSD has been described. It is rather a terrifying life. So as a result of chronic and interpersonal trauma, this individual will be extremely vigilant, very watchful for danger all the time, constantly expecting it, live with chronic anxiety and terror. All of their psychological energy is bent by necessity toward coping, which means things like hiding, self-protecting, rather than having that psychological energy bent toward learning and growing, which is where a healthy child in a healthy environment gets to go. They get to imagine, they get to experiment, they get to test, they get to learn. They don't have to keep coping with this trauma over here all the time. The victim has been betrayed and is often either separated from those who are caregivers and nurturers, or they are stuck with those who are not. There is no safe person in their life. They don't know what that means. So let me give you a few broad categories of the impact of this ongoing interpersonal trauma in the life of a developing child. You think about child development, and I'm assuming many of you have or have had children. Children are malleable, like clay. That means they are capable of being shaped. So they're developing a sense of person. You know, when you have an infant, you don't know who the infant's going to turn out to be. Well, neither does the infant. The infant has not discovered himself yet. So the child, as they grow, is supposed to be answering the question, who am I? What can I do? What can't I do? What am I good at? Do I matter? Do I have impact? If I cry, does somebody come? Am I lovable? Just as children develop knowledge and skills, like how to walk and talk and eat or do math, so they develop a sense of self, a personhood, as we might say, an awareness and sense, a definition and assessment of myself. The impact of chronic interpersonal violence on that process is staggering. Secondly, complex trauma involves betrayal at its core. You think about this. The person is being hurt by someone they should be able to trust. Parent, grandparent, siblings, uncles and aunts, coach, pastor, teacher. Those are all the people that along the way of the child's growing who should be caretaking, protecting, teaching, nurturing. Those who should help not only fail to help, but repeatedly morally damage the child and erode their sense of self. So the self is marinated in abandonment, deception, blame, humiliation, and isolation. And you know when you marinate something, you do it so the flavor gets all the way in. So when you're a child being marinated in these things, it gets all the way in. Third, as a result, the child victim develops a deep and abiding sense of shame. Anybody who's been around children for just a small amount of time knows that children think egocentrically. They believe they are the center of the universe. Most of us grow out of that. But what happens is, because they think that way, they think when something bad happens, it's their fault. So you might, if you're working with a child whose parents are going through a difficult divorce or something, you know, a little boy might say, you know, if I were a good little boy, mommy and daddy wouldn't be getting a divorce. Well, that's an outright lie. But the child can't see beyond himself for many years. That's just the way humans develop. And then often, of course, those bad things that they assume responsibility for, that responsibility is reinforced with blaming words, shaming words, by the supposed caretakers. So, for example, an uncle might say to a little girl, you know, I wouldn't sexually abuse you if you weren't so seductive. So she already thinks she's the center of the universe, and now he's proven to her that she is, and who she is bad. Children who grow up in complex trauma do not see themselves as doing bad things. They see themselves as the essence of bad. So they believe that the self is disordered. So this category has been developed in recent years because the research has shown that those people who are typically diagnosed with PTSD, out of that, many of them were found by clinicians to be 8 times more likely to have additional disorders than people who did not have PTSD. So we used to see people with PTSD and then say, well, they also have major depression and they also have maybe a dissociative disorder and they have an eating disorder and they have an addiction. Well, you know, you've got a page full of diagnoses. So somebody had a light go on in their brain and said, wait a minute, maybe these aren't all different diagnoses. Maybe they all are subsets of one. And that's how complex trauma developed. So they started talking about that. There's a history of that. But I think what we need to know as people who interact with people in a very traumatizing world, that we need an understanding of complex trauma, because if we're going to help people who've been marinated in this stuff, we want to consider really who they are and understand how they see us and hear us. Because oftentimes we'll see the damage and we'll want to help. But if we don't understand who we're helping, we will actually not help and sometimes do damage. So there are parts of the person that are altered when they are marinated in trauma. And I want to go through some of those, the things that change as the child develops. So when you get to be an adult, these things are different than they would have been in a healthy environment. The first has to do with regulating your emotions and your impulses. That's profoundly impacted when you're marinated like this. People who have been in prolonged trauma tend to overreact to stress. They become easily overwhelmed. They exhibit intense anger or rage. They have very great difficulty calming themselves down. They do not know how to self-soothe. They are often self-destructive. Eating disorders, addictions, self-injury, cutting, things like that. They don't know how to modulate anger and other feelings. They don't know how to manage impulses, like an impulse for suicide, or sexual acting out, or risk-taking behavior. Sometimes they will modulate their feelings by doing things we think are bad for them, and we would be right. But for example, addictions and self-harm make people feel numb. To somebody who has all of these symptoms, that's a good place to live. So they have to do something destructive in order to have any sense of quiet or peace. Second, we also see alterations or changes in the way the person is able to be attentive or conscious about things. Chronic trauma is, by definition, inescapable. It's very distressing. It overwhelms all the normal coping mechanisms that humans use. You know, if somebody's hurting you, you get away if you can. Or you fight back if you can. Or you tell them to stop. Or you get help. None of those things work when a child is being chronically traumatized. And so when there's no way to get away from that which is terrifying and overwhelming, the only way to get away is in here. And so children who live like this often use dissociation, which is simply a way of taking the mind away from the present and putting it someplace inside that actually isn't out here in the physical world. So you might talk to people. It has a similar effect to addictions because it helps them get removed from the trauma. So you might talk to somebody who will say something to you like, you know, when I was a little girl, I used to feel like I was able to hide up in the corner of the ceiling under the paper on the wallflower. And what you come to find out is that that's where she took herself in her mind while she was being sexually abused. So what happens is that capacity to leave the present and go be someplace else in your mind gets habituated over time. And one of the things that that does is make people who are terrified all the time they're going to get hurt not able to protect themselves. One of the things the research has showed is that, for example, women with long histories of sexual abuse who have complex trauma are more frequently raped than the general population of women. And the reason for that is that if you are an incest survivor and you're walking down a dark alley in your city and you hear footsteps, your mind will leave. So you can't take care of yourself and pay attention to what's going on. Is it safe? Is it not safe? Do I need to run? You quit processing what's happening in the front of your mind and you retreat to your hiding place in your mind. So you're unaware. You block out what you're hearing and you're obviously much more likely then to get hurt. So there are several studies that have shown that if somebody does that when they're being traumatized, it is the most significant long-term predictor for the development of a trauma disorder. So somebody who's had chronic trauma and done something in their head to help them escape it, it's pretty dead certain sure they're going to be diagnosed with a trauma disorder. Victims who suffer such personal abuse prior to the age of 14 develop even more dissociative responses. Those whose trauma begins in the very early years, age 2, 3, 4, 5, can often develop what we refer to as dissociative identity disorder, used to be called multiple personalities. Trauma has its most pervasive impact when it occurs in a child or an adolescent, because again, they're malleable, and so they are now being shaped by evil with no protection. What happens when the mind leaves like that and dissociates is that the information and the experiences are not regulated. And so they get, it's as if somebody had a bunch of file drawers in their head. And so this thing that happened when I was 3 in my bedroom goes in this file, and this thing that happened when I was 12 and at my uncle's farm goes in this file. And what you will find with people who have suffered from complex trauma or this disorder is they can't tell you a story of their lives. They can give you pieces like this, but they've never made a narrative out of it because in their mind they kept leaving what was happening. And of course, trauma, if we really look at it, defies our normal categories. I spent 4 hours yesterday at Auschwitz. It defies normal categories. I mean, you can say it was bad. You can say it was evil. I mean, even that doesn't say it. So here you have a child growing up with things that adults can't put into words. And they're supposed to manage it somehow and still grow up. There are no files in the brain of a child where their whole abusive experience can be remembered and understood. It's not possible. Think about it. You have a 5-year-old girl. She lives in a house where she's chronically neglected, which means she's not fed regularly. Sometimes she's put down in the cellar and a piece of bread is tossed down. Nobody touches her except to hit her. Nobody tucks her in at night. She has no toys. Nobody's ever read her a story. She is beaten and raped repeatedly. And in addition to all of this going on in her home, she's living in a war zone. And she's lost one of her parents, the only one that might have been kind. Now, to absorb those memories as a five-year-old girl and the sensations of them, the voices you heard, the smells, the pain, the things that you saw, the twisting of the mind so it's full of lies, the emotional aspects, if she didn't go away in her head, she'd be stark raving mad. So on the one hand, you have these people developing these tremendous resources by dissociating, which leaves them unprotected and without a narrative, neither of which is good for people as adults. But on the other hand, if they didn't do that while it was happening, they would be insane. If you cannot escape physically, the one possible coping mechanism is to escape in your mind. So abuse like that in certain places, with certain people, causes people to split their brains. There's a very excellent book that was published in 1991 by Lawrence Langer, L-A-N-G-E-R, called Holocaust Testimonies, The Ruins of Memory. And I was fascinated when I first read it in the 90s. He was studying the memories of those who survived the Nazi Holocaust. And what he realized was that their memories, again, did not tell a narrative. They were all split up. Langer says that memory functions, or it continues on, whether or not we talk about it. And he says that since memory cannot be silenced in the mind, it might as well be heard. The story needs to be told. The point is whether memory is spoken or not, it continues to impact the life. It often speaks through symptoms, even when someone does not consciously remember the cause of those symptoms. Langer uses the term anguished memory. It's quite a phrase. It refers to memory that people have stored that assaults and finally divides the self. And he said the Holocaust survivors talk about the inability to take their times in the death camps and then tell the story and link it right into their freedom, their marriage, their children, all of those things. You can't make a story out of that. One woman said, I split myself. It wasn't me there. It just wasn't me. I was somebody else. Another one said, my head is filled with garbage and all these images, you know, and sounds, smells, and you can't cut it out. But it's there. It's like there's another skin beneath this skin, and you can't shed it. I am not like you. You have one vision of life. I have two. One more, there's a sort of division, you know, a compartmentalizing of what happened, and it's very tightly separated, but it really isn't. It must not interfere in my life today, the one that I have that's safe and good. The other must not become so overwhelming, it will make me unable to function in my now normal life. The double of Auschwitz does not mingle with my present life. It is as if it were not me at all. So, if you think about it, these are Holocaust survivors, but these are the types of things that people say who have grown up as children in chronic traumatic situations. All right, the next category in terms of alterations is destruction of the way we perceive ourselves. And again, if you've raised children, been around small children, you know they're just trying to figure out who they are. You know, you start out with an infant who sees this thing going across its eyes and doesn't even know it's its own hand attached to its own body and actually can do something about it. Developing a sense of self in very basic ways that get more complex as time goes on. What they end up developing as a sense of self is, I'm damaged, flawed, I'm ineffective. I'm incompetent. I couldn't stop it. I'm full of shame. I'm marked. Everybody can tell. I'm unlovable and undesirable, and I'm helpless. Victims blame themselves and believe no one will understand, and so they try to forget or they minimize horrific evil. They carry a great sense of shame. Not just about what was done to them, but thinking that it was done because of who they are. This is easily exacerbated in honor-shame cultures, where, for example, to be raped is to have shamed the family, church, the entire village. Fourth, changes in perceptions of the perpetrator. Many victims constantly think about their abuser. They're terrified he's going to show up. They're planning revenge. They're fearful he will appear. They feel controlled by him, even if he's long dead. They will take the perpetrator's view of themselves. So they attribute total power to the abuser. Judith Herman, who wrote the book Trauma and Recovery, which is an excellent book if you really want to understand trauma, cautions us because what she says is that oftentimes a clinician or a counselor wants to downplay the power that the abuser holds. The fact is, there are some very evil and very powerful people out there, and extreme fear in your patient should not simply be seen as the old childhood reaction she still hasn't gotten over. I've had clients in my office who were sexually abused by men in the father's family who were part of the mafia. She should be afraid. So that kind of thing happens all the time, that we want to make it less sometimes when we're working with somebody. Well, you know, you're safe now. Maybe. You could be working with somebody, you know, again, whose family was in organized crime, who was in trafficking, something like that. The seemingly excessive fear is sometimes solidly grounded in reality. And obviously in places where there's war and ethnic violence and ongoing rape, fear is a measure of true instability in the area, not overreaction in the victim. You talk to a rape victim in Congo, she doesn't want to go garden. Why doesn't she want to go garden? She's afraid of being raped. You can't tell her. She won't be. Another aspect of this is that victims can sometimes significantly bond with their perpetrator. You know, a child needs people to attach to. And I've often heard of stories in homes where the father is the perpetrator and the mother never does anything or says anything, so she's complicit. But the father is also the kindest parent. That makes all kinds of scrambled things in a child's brain. So this is the one who buys me new shoes, who got me a bicycle, who makes sure I'm registered at the school. And this is the one who rapes me at night. And so there's a particular bond there, that same bond as in domestic violence victims, when they live with a batterer. It's in trafficked victims, many of whom call their pimps daddy. It's in incest victims. The bonding is necessary for the child to grow up, but it's also a terrible dilemma. Fifth, we see distortions in relationships. Obviously, repetitive and premeditated abuse can result in all kinds of disorders. When an individual is chronically mistreated and abused, it often leads to recurring victimization. It leads to the inability to trust, and sometimes to victimizing others. Victims are often unable to feel any intimacy with somebody. They have no model in their minds for what a healthy relationship should look like. And so they don't know how to make good or wise judgments. You know, you can't do what you've never seen and can't imagine. You know, how do you have a healthy marriage if you've never seen one? And so you really can't even picture it in your head. Sometimes they see warning signs in relationships. Sometimes they don't. When they don't, they're re-victimized. But when they do, they are often immediately put into a state of feeling helpless. There's nothing I can do about it. These struggles will impact you as you work with them, because the struggle to trust, obviously, then somebody comes to talk to you, you're going to be the next person they don't trust. And we want them to feel safe. We probably work hard for them to feel safe in their time with us. But if you say to them, it's okay, it's safe here, why would they believe you? They're not going to. They may act like they do because they've learned how to be compliant and not upset people. But you can't trust that they really trust. That's something that's won over time, and usually a long time. The sixth category is a big word we call somatization. This is a new area. It's often not understood. There's growing research that shows that chronic trauma impacts the body physiologically and the brain, changes the brain. Chronic exposure to stress compromises the stress response system in the body, the capacity to evaluate stimuli, to encode verbal memory, and it hinders information processing. So you take that information right there and think, okay, what happens to a little boy who's trying to get through school and learn how to read, and all that stuff's happening to his body and his mind? Traumatized individuals have overreactive nervous systems. You know, one of those, which we're familiar with from PTSD, is the exaggerated startle response. You know, if you come up behind somebody who's been traumatized, they'll jump through the ceiling. Overproduction of certain chemicals results in constant anxiety. They don't know what it's like not to feel anxious. They have great difficulty sleeping, which, of course, has a great impact on their health. Current research has found immune system dysfunctions in many women with histories of chronic childhood abuse. And I have watched this through the years. I'm not a medical doctor. It's puzzled me. The reaction of the medical community 20, 25 years ago was, it's not really a disorder. They made it up in their minds for attention or whatever. But research is now showing, actually, that chronic childhood abuse impacts our immune autoimmune stuff, you know, causes autoimmune diseases. So patients often end up silent and treated with disbelief and hostility. I've had patients who've undergone 10, 12 unnecessary surgeries because somebody felt like they needed to do something to tell them that they would be better now, only it didn't work, and it didn't work because it wasn't really about the physical pain they were feeling. It was about the emotional pain and the story of their lives that was still untouched by all of the surgeries. The final category is changes in meaning, which obviously has a whole spiritual impact, results in despair, hopelessness, or the loss of former beliefs. These clients have a very difficult time making sense out of life. And they believe that the God who allows such abuse is very confusing at best and evil at worst. So to process a history of chronic, brutal trauma threatens every belief formerly or currently held. And I can tell you that if you sit with people like this, it'll affect your faith as well. So following a traumatic experience, every human being, no matter their age, has to make the heartbreaking adjustment to a world that is full of losses. So if you're a 5-year-old girl or boy and you've just been raped by a family member, yesterday was one world and today and the rest of your life is another. If you're a college student and you were raped on the campus, if you're a combat vet who never saw violence before and you went to war and lost your buddies to IEDs or whatever, you have a before and an after. When trauma begins in early childhood, it's all that is known. There is no before. Trauma involves an event that threatens life or safety. It takes away choice. You don't get to say whether you want it or not, and results in overwhelming fear. When these things happen to human beings, they feel alone. They often are. They feel helpless. They often are. Humiliated and without hope. So following trauma, a portion of the person, if not the whole person, turns inward, away from life. They can't handle outside here and in here at the same time. So you will sometimes see that in children who can't handle what's happening to them, and so they abandon life and flunk out of school and do all kinds of things. They don't proactively engage with life because so much of their energy is turned inside. Eventually, however, post-trauma, life is at some point going to have to go on if the person is going to return to the outside world. So what kinds of things are needed to help people face what's inside remember well and truthfully, and yet still be able to return to life and to good things, relationships. Recovery, and this is a very important statement, so I want you to really hear it, and we'll work with it a little bit later. Recovery involves a reversal of the experience of trauma. So you have to understand the dynamics of trauma so that you can reverse the dynamics in whatever caregiving relationship you have with them. Trauma silences human beings, partly because there's no words to really describe what that was like. It brings emotional darkness, isolation, because you feel like nobody cares, or even if they did, they wouldn't understand. It makes time stand still, because we get so lost in what happened, we cannot see ahead. We've lost hope. So there are three main things that need to occur to reverse the trauma. All three must happen. One is not enough. And the three things are this: talking, tears, and time. Now, talking is part of being human. It's how God made us. It's actually one of the ways we're like Him. He talks, we talk. He created all things at the beginning through His voice. He has told us who He is through His written word and through His word made flesh. He means for us to talk. He means for us to express ourselves, to dialogue with Him and with each other, to be creative in that expression, to experiment, to imagine, to make things happen that have never been on the earth before. When somebody does not talk, and I don't just mean words, though that's certainly significant, but express themselves in some way, if all that's shut down, they're broken. Now, there may be something physically wrong, but there also may be a tremendous amount of emotional wounding that causes it. And sometimes people do not talk at all, or do not talk about a particular event, because the pain is so great they cannot find the words. Or the other thing they do is they keep saying the same thing over and over again, trying to find the right words and get relief, only it doesn't do anything. When Ground Zero happened in New York, I was up in New York a month after that to speak at a conference on trauma, for obvious reasons. And I was with a woman who had been in the towers and had obviously managed to get out. And she was standing on the sidewalk watching as the people were jumping. And the only thing she could say to me was, and not you, she must have said it 50 times, "I saw the color of their ties." That's all she could tell me about that story. Now, over time, that story took on, you know, she was able to tell me how she got out and how she got on the subway and got away from all of that. But at the beginning, that's all she could do. So it's not uncommon for somebody, like a child even, "He hurt me." "Well, honey, how did he hurt you?" "He hurt me." "Can you show me where?" "He hurt me." That's all she can say. Talking is absolutely necessary for recovery. Words are inadequate, and that must be honored. Whatever narrative they eventually give you really doesn't cover it. But to remain silent is to fail to honor the event and the memory. And honor the event, not the evil of the event, but to live in the truth of what really happened and not pretend. By saying it was not only did it really happen, but it was really evil. And it really did damage. You know, if you've worked with victims, and they'll say, "Well, yes, I was sexually abused, but I've already dealt with it, and now I need you to help me with this." "Well, can you tell me what that means, that you already dealt with it?" "I just said that it happened. It was no big deal." Ding. Not dealt with. And so talking is not just fact stating, it's expressing what happened and the impact of it on the person. It dishonors victims when we are silent about their experience, or pretend it did not happen, or was not important. And unfortunately, this has happened a great deal in the church. We have silenced victims of domestic violence. We've silenced victims of sexual abuse and rape. We've silenced combat vets. And we give them a verse and tell them to be quiet. Hawking says, I'm here. I'm alive. Which for some people with chronic trauma, that's an amazing statement. And what happened to me was wrong, and it wasn't my wrong. I'm damaged by it. Justice is needed, but so is care for my broken heart. At the beginning, sometimes people are so silenced, they can't talk in words. So sometimes you might sit with somebody who's traumatized, and all they can do is cry, or moan, or rock. Sometimes I use nonverbal things. When they say, I can't tell you, can you draw me a picture of this? They can do that. I had a ballerina as a client many, many years ago who could not tell me the story about her grandfather. So I said, go home and design a dance that tells the story. So she did. She came back and she danced. And then I knew the story. And then I could work with her to help her put words to what she had danced. So many times, people need us to sit with them in silence. God commended Job's friends when they did that part. It's a way of joining with them. So they're not alone in the darkness. There is someone else there. Eventually, words will and must come. It's part of how you get power over something, is to be able to tell it. Sometimes people need help. So sometimes, again, even though people are starting to talk, I'll just give them one word. And if it describes what you felt or saw, just nod your head. Scary. Pain. Good. So you're helping them find words. Little by little, they give you pieces of the story. And trauma stories do not come out with a beginning, a middle, and an end. They come out like this, and eventually you have to put the puzzle together. Talking is about telling the truth. It connects the survivor to another person, and it restores dignity because you're willing to sit there and listen and honor them. It gives them choice because they can decide when to tell, what to say, and when to stop. That's not yours to choose. And again, remember my sentence, you know, trauma recovery is the reversal of the dynamics of the trauma. The dynamics of the trauma were coercion. You had no choice. So forcing somebody to tell their story in a therapy session or coming alongside them is to copy a dynamic of trauma. You're not helping. Yes, they need to talk, but if they do it under coercion, that feels to them like the perpetrator. Injustice and violence and abuse teach us lies. They teach us that we're worthless and do not matter. Trauma tells the truth and gives dignity. Violence and abuse disconnect us from relationships, and we're alone and not considered. Telling the trauma story gives a place for caring connection with you. Trauma requires talking and being repeated and grasped. Trauma recovery also requires tears. Facing a new world full of losses brings incredible grief. And I often find that the grief feelings are what victims are most afraid of touching. They can tell you a story sort of like a robot. Just don't get me talking about how I feel. They think if they start to grieve, they'll never stop. They have feelings of fear and sadness and isolation and shame and despair, anger. They're strong emotions. They're hard to experience, and they have probably not been taught how to regulate themselves so they're not completely overwhelmed again by their own feelings. But feelings must be expressed because they tell the story as much as the words do. And they tell, part of what they tell is the story of the impact. They express what trauma did to the victim in the same way blood shows what a cut did to the skin. So it's like seeing and acknowledging the physical wounds on the body after an accident. For some people, words come first. And again, they may have to come non-verbally. But eventually, so sometimes people will tell the story in a very rote way, but eventually you go back and revisit the story and say, okay, you told me this happened to you when you were 6. Can you tell me what you felt about that then? No. Well, can you tell me what you feel about it now? If it were another 6-year-old, how would you feel? So you back it up when they can't do it until they can. It's very important for us to remember that telling a trauma story, facing the truth that you wish were not true, and expressing the emotions that accompany takes tremendous courage. Many people can't do it alone and shouldn't. They need a safe connection with a caring, wise, and patient person to grant them the courage to face the truth. Many emotions can't be adequately expressed in words. And again, so I told you about the ballerina. You look for not just the story to be told in words, but the feeling. Sometimes people will paint something and just black and red, and that's it. And they're full of rage and despair. There's a verse in the book of Psalms in chapter 56 that says, "You," meaning God, "have taken account of my mourning and put my tears in your bottle. Are they not also in your book?" That's an amazing concept for somebody who's never allowed themselves to cry about what happened to them. And oftentimes the emotions that victims of trauma have are extremely strong, and they're feelings that the Christian community is a little queasy about. I mean, what do you do with all that anger? Be angry and sin not. What do you do with all that fear? God's not given us the spirit of fear. So we have to be very careful that we do not try to fix what is in front of us so that we feel better. It's a very easy trap to fall into, particularly when we not only are uncomfortable with those feelings, but we're afraid of them. Okay, last one, third part. The third piece of dealing with this is time. So you have talking, tears, and time. Now, in case you haven't noticed, we don't have control over time. When we want it to go fast, it feels really slow. And when we want it to feel slow, it goes too fast. And we can't go back and undo. Whatever happened in time back there stands. What we do today stands. And so it's very important to understand that there is a significant factor that by itself is not healing. Time does not heal all wounds. If you've got an infection on your leg, time might lead to losing your leg if you don't get it tended. So that does not speak the truth. People will often say that to trauma survivors, that time will heal it. It does not. It must include the talking and the tears. But we need to remember that we are with somebody who's in tremendous pain, telling the story and remembering and in many ways re-experiencing it inside. And so we have to not only remind them that it takes time. One of my phrases that I use all the time with my clients is little by little. Let's look at this part, and then let's do something skill-based over here that is nurturing or good for you. Then let's look at this part. So yes, does that make it take more time? It does, but what you're doing, again, is not allowing a trauma to overwhelm them in the recovery process, just like it did when it was originally happening. So you need to not only recognize that it takes time, but you also need to recognize that you can use time to help them learn new ways of living. So, for example, you might have had a client who gets overwhelmed whenever she thinks about her story or tries to tell it and goes home and cuts herself. It's not a good therapeutic outcome. That's not what you want to happen. So you end up teaching her how to do something like deep breathing exercises. And there's a great little video on YouTube you might look at. Dr. Weil, W-E-I-L. If you just type in his name, YouTube, breathing, you'll find it. And what he literally does with, and a lot of my patients use this, what he literally does is sit there and teach them how to do a breathing that quiets them, because mostly they breathe very shallow because of the fear and anxiety. And so he does it with them and he teaches them how. And you can't, if you do that breathing, it quiets your body. And for some clients, it's the first time they've ever had a quiet body. They didn't know what it was like not to feel anxious every single moment of every single day and all night long if you weren't sleeping. So you want to teach them those skills so that as the time passes, they can take care of themselves with your help in nurturing ways. I would also caution you and tell you that what you don't want to do is become their Xanax. You know, you're the safe person. They're telling you the story. every time something happens, they're going to want to send you a note or write you or call you or something and not learn how to manage themselves. So if you let that happen, so clear boundaries are very important when you're helping people who are traumatized, because boundaries were clearly overrun when they were being traumatized. But if you, in your helping, allow boundaries to be overrun, you're still going to have a person who cannot regulate their own emotions, their own impulses, or self-soothe. So again, it's a reversal of that dynamic. You're there, you're with, you're teaching, but you're also giving skills so they can manage themselves and then come back to the story, manage their skills, come back to the story. So what are the three things? Yes, talking, tears, and time. There's a whole world of literature out there that can give you a whole lot of other things, and we'll talk about some a bit more in the next time after the coffee break. Just a few clinical things I want you to learn. But if you hold on to those and the statement that everything you do must be a reversal of the dynamics of trauma, you will help and you will not hurt them again.